I'm Jerry Gagosian, and before we get started with today's episode of Art Smack, I'm here like a PBS commercial to ask you to support us. So there's a bunch of different ways that you can support Art Smack, as we are an extremely tiny creative enterprise that makes up a team of me, Annie Taylor, and Joe Tisdall. So how do you support us, you may be wondering? Well, first of all, lowest lift, highest impact. Please go to whatever platform it is that you're listening to the podcast or watching the podcast on, subscribe to us and give us 5 stars. That actually helps us a lot, and it helps people discover us when they're looking for an art podcast. The other way that you can support us is to find our Spotify for Podcasters page, which is going to be linked in each episode in the bottom. And you can click on that. And within that, there's an opportunity for you to continually support us or just give us a one-time donation. And that can be anything from donating $1.99, $4.99, $9.99. So it's really up to you and whatever you feel you can give and whatever you feel the podcast is worth to you on a weekly basis. And then finally, the big juicy people who want to really contribute and help support us, you can very easily become a supporter and also an advertiser on this podcast by contacting Anne, A-N-N-E, at gogosian.com. It's pretty simple. And we will send you over our media kit and our deck so that you can see all of our fabulous numbers and analytics, and you can see how worth it is to become a supporter of the Art Smack podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. We're so happy to be back for season 2. You're already off to a great start, and we have a really good season on the way. Thanks so much and enjoy the episode.
Welcome back to Art Smack. I'm your host, Jerry Gagosian, with my co-host, Annie Taylor, and our very special guest today, Magnus Resch. And we're here to discuss, what number in your series of books is this?
So this is number 8 in total.
Number 8. Mm-hmm. So far.
I think it's my last one.
Oh, no. I don't believe it.
I think it's my last one.
How to Collect Art. Great read. Mm-hmm. Actually, an incredible, could we call it a field guide to beginning to understand collecting art?
Yes, I think so. Why I wrote this book is I wanted to introduce people to the art world. What I realized is that there are so many people out there who like art, who go to art events, but who are not buying. The biggest problem in the art world is a conversion problem, Converting visitors into buyers. Mm-hmm. And I'm confronted with these type of people constantly. My brother is one of them. All my friends who I studied economics with are some of them. Because they all have reached a certain level in their career where they can afford to buy an art piece, but they don't know where to start. And for those people, I wrote this book.
Yeah, I think it's a great introduction for people who do not buy art or who are looking to get into art. So if you had to sum up this book in 3 points for someone who's looking to buy their first piece of art at the upcoming Mayfairs, what would that be?
First thing, art is not a good investment. So don't look for investment potential. Whatever you buy, most likely you will not see the money again because there's no resale market.
Yeah.
Secondly, buy what you like. It's that simple. I asked 200 of the top collectors in the world, what's your one line of advice for someone who's starting to collect? And most of them said the same thing, buy what you like. Mm-hmm. Buy with your eyes, not with your ears. Mm-hmm. So go around, see as much art as you can. And thirdly, well, for the third one, you have to buy the book.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would like to hear, I know you said in the book that you don't buy as an investment, you're more into responsibility buying. Can you weigh responsibility buying versus buying as an investment?
I like that you're using that phrase because I came up with it.
Yeah. Right? I like that phrase.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's good.
I think it resonates with people who are maybe looking to invest in a community and not care so much about a return.
And maybe it sticks. The idea is, so I'm an economist. I look at data in the art world. I teach at Yale courses on art economics. I wrote my PhD on that topic. I was always interested more in the data perspective mm-hmm. of the art market rather than an art historical perspective. Now, looking at all this data, I realized, hey, art is not a good investment. It's only a good investment for the very top end of the market, mm-hmm. the same artists that we all know that make it into a museum and so on. So why should I buy art then, mm-hmm. right? If most likely the money that I spend on it is just gone. And that's really where I came up with the term responsible buying. And what I mean with it is that you're not buying to see an investment potential, but you're investing in something which is way greater than that. You're investing in an artist, you're investing in a gallery that is supporting the artist, and you're investing in yourself because you get so much more out of art than just seeing your money increase. You get an emotional resonance from it. You live with art, it changes everything, right? This room would look so different if there weren't art all around us. It tells me so much about you and the art that you're collecting. With responsible buying, it's really almost a philanthropic act rather than an investment.
Okay. And any of the artists that you've purchased, have you seen a return on any of those?
Yeah. But those were lucky shots.
Yeah.
And initially, my journey is very similar. So I started in the art world. I'm not from one of these art collector families. I grew up in the art world with no contacts, no knowledge about anything. I went to school in Düsseldorf, mm-hmm. which is in Germany. As you might have guessed from my accent, I'm German. So I went to school and my school was directly next to the famous Düsseldorf Art Academy, where Gerhard Richter was a professor, Andreas Gursky was a professor, Peter Doig, and all these people were teaching there. And that's where I met, because we were sharing the same street with a lot of bars on it. Mm-hmm. So that's where I met a couple of artists.
Out at a bar?
At a bar. As a side note, drinking age in Germany is at 16. So we were hanging out there. And that's where I met a couple of artists who were just a little bit older than I was. I then went on to the army and stayed in touch with them. And that's really how I started to get involved with the art world. And initially I thought, oh, I'm very smart. I'm going to buy some of these artists very early on. And they're going to have a career like Basquiat,
yeah.
Warhol. Those are the names that I was familiar with. Turns out many of them didn't. But some of them did and actually still have a very respectable career. For example, Chris Zucco is one of them. I bought Chris Zucco. He was one of the first artists I ever bought. I bought him for $500. And he's now, you know, with Almin Rech mm-hmm. selling for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 at auctions and so on. Mm-hmm. The other question you probably ask me, you know, have I ever sold an art mm-hmm. piece? No, I haven't.
Wow. And why is that?
Just because... I don't know, transaction costs are very high, so I probably wouldn't make much money. And also, I really like living with it.
Yeah.
Every piece that I have tells a story. Mm-hmm. To every artist that I collect, I have a personal connection to. I have their phone number in mm-hmm. my mobile. I can text them. So that's always important to me.
So you're investing in the artist and their artwork.
Yeah, but that's something that I learned further down the road. Initially, I joined the art market because I thought it's a great way to make some money. Mm-hmm. I started off, you know, buying at an affordable price, and then I switched sides. I started selling mm-hmm. those works from the artists who I knew because they were all struggling mm-hmm. and I didn't have that much money to buy any work.
Yeah.
So when I started my university career, which was expensive, I wanted to make some extra money, and that's how I really got involved in the art world.
You opened your first gallery at 20,
yes.
right? So what was the price point for artists you were exhibiting?
Super low end, $2,000, $1,000. Those were the artists who were still showing at the academy.
Yeah.
Those were the first artists that I was selling. And I sold them to my brother's friends. My brother is a little bit older.
Yeah.
He went into investment banking, and from their first bonus... These guys, you know, they were going out mm-hmm. to nightclubs and yeah. Impressing their girlfriends, mm-hmm. buying them something, maybe a watch. And what was left over is what I tried to get. So I was flying to London and had art in my carry-on
cool.
and sold them, you know.
You can relate to that so much.
As a logistics girl, I don't love that, but I respect the hustle. You mentioned in your book that you exhibited at
Thanks
Scope.
Thanks for reading it.
I annotated.
Thank you. Wow, look at this.
You'll sign that later for me. Yeah. But so I read that you exhibited at Scope. I actually worked at Scope for 4 years as their curatorial and ER head. And you mentioned in this book that Scope is a gamma fair, and I would like you to break down how you categorize alpha, beta, gamma, and delta fairs.
So what I do in the book is I'm trying to make the art market more accessible. Mm-hmm. There are 20,000 galleries. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows, most people know Gagosian, mm-hmm. right? Most people know David Zwirner, but Hauser and Wirth, it already gets complicated. I'm not talking about the people who are already in the art world. I'm talking about, you know, our friends who are not actively going. And these people don't know what Art Basel is. Mm-hmm. They know they go to Miami and there's Art Basel, but mm-hmm. they don't know that it's based on a city in Switzerland.
Yeah.
So the level that we are talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. Art Basel.
It's Basel, obviously.
Basel. And to them, Scope, Untitled.
It's all Art Basel.
It's all Art Basel,
yeah.
right? I mean, Adidas made a new sneaker with Art Basel on it, not even being aware that it's actually a brand, you know, and so on. A huge scandal if you Google it a couple of years ago. But anyway.
I want those shoes.
Yeah, me too. We should rock them in June at the fair.
So having all this, everything is kind of the same, right? Also, the spaces look the same. When you go to Chelsea, you cannot separate a top gallery from a less known gallery because they all look the same. White walls, similar floor, and so on. And what I try to do in the book is I try to give classifications to help people navigate through all of this. Mm-hmm. One very good way to identify what type of gallery am I buying from? Is that a superstar gallery that has superstar artists and also expensive prices? Or is that a gallery more at the lower end with more affordable prices? Mm-hmm. And how do you, the easiest way to do this is by looking at the art fairs that galleries are exhibiting at. So alpha art fairs are the top art fairs. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Which ones are those?
Fries, TAFEF, Basel.
Exactly. Thanks for reading my book.
Well, I think we all knew that before the book.
Yeah, exactly.
And then better art fairs, give me some.
Untitled.
Nada. The Independent.
Independent, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So those are better art fairs. They're roughly 15. There are 3 alpha art fairs, 15 better art fairs, and then you have everything else. There are 300 art fairs, and then everything else is kind of, you know, more local fairs. Mm-hmm. And Scope is one of those fairs that have an international footprint.
No longer.
Oh, no longer there.
Only Miami now.
Only Miami. See, there we go. So I went through the entire journey. Now they're only Miami. The galleries that are showing there are at lower price points and so on. So just by looking at the art fair helps galleries to understand what type of people to understand what type of gallery that is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you don't find any of the alpha galleries exhibiting at beta fairs? No.
Well, obviously, you know, sometimes when you look at Lister Basel, for example, that's a stepping stone. Yeah. Nada is a stepping stone. So sometimes you have current alpha galleries who showed in better art fairs previously because they also go through a journey. But in generally, there is a match between alpha galleries, alpha art fairs, better galleries, better art fairs.
And okay, so you say there are 4 alpha galleries right now. I'd like to hear if there was a 5th. Who do you think is going to climb in that slot?
So interesting ones are White Cube and Ropach because they are in between. They don't focus so much on the secondary market. Mm-hmm. When you look at alpha galleries, those are Pace, David Zwirner, Hauser and Wirth, and?
Gago.
And some people might be more familiar with the term mega gallery.
Yeah, mega gallery, alpha gallery, superstar gallery. Those are the ones, when you look at their revenue channels, half of it is primary market and half of it is secondary market.
Okay.
When you look at YCube and Ropach, they really focus more on primary market. They're not so active in the secondary market. That's why their revenue numbers are lower than those mega galleries that are more in the $1 billion range.
Yeah.
And then you have the better level, where you have galleries like Sprutmagers, Perrotin, and those galleries.
And for people that follow Jerry Gagosian, we call those mega minus galleries.
Mega what?
Mega minus.
Right.
So there's mega, mega minus, mid-tier, and emerging.
But you know what I find so interesting? The gap between the alpha galleries, the mega galleries, and the next level is huge. And you see this everywhere, right? I mean, in terms of, just look at the revenue numbers. They're more in the $1 billion range. The better galleries are more in the 150, 200 million range. That's $800 million difference.
Yeah.
Same with auction houses. Mm-hmm. When you look at the revenue of Sotheby's and Christie's, they're in the $6 billion range, but the next one comes at a $1 billion range. Yeah. Huge gap. Same with artists. Mm-hmm. My alpha or superstar artists, as I call them, and here again I did a classification, are so far removed in terms of revenue, price points, attention that they get from the next category.
So I would like to hear where you were able to discern these revenue numbers, because the art world is not transparent. And I wasn't aware that, you know, White Cube is making close to $1 billion and Gagosian is making significantly more than that. Where were you able to come up with those numbers?
So, yeah, the art market is a black box. My entire past 20 years, I've always been looking at numbers simply because I was interested to cut through all the personal accounts, the anecdotal evidence that people are always talking about, and trying to gather numbers. So, for example, my PhD, I wrote it 15, 20 years ago, is based on a large-scale survey that I sent to galleries that they could anonymously put in their revenue numbers and so on. Obviously, the big, the four mega ones didn't participate in that, so I didn't draw the information from there. And that is really, some in some countries, the records are public. So in the UK, you can see the revenue numbers of every gallery,
because
Sweden, Germany, and so on. And then you can take an informed guess. And obviously, you know, people working at those companies, leaving them, they sometimes share information. I don't know the exact numbers. Is it 1.2? Is it 800 million? But it's something in that range. All the numbers in the art world. We always refer to the Art Basel UBS market report that shares, all right, the market is 60 billion. When you think of it, as an from an academic point of view, it's a very wild guess. Half of it you get through public auction results, right? You just add up the numbers that Sotheby's, Christie's and the other 1,000 auction houses are doing. So you get a good idea of that part of the art world. But the primary market really is a black box. And Claire McAndrews, who does a really good job there.
I love her.
She relies on survey methods and also looks into public records. But you can only gather it to a certain extent. So everything in the art world, when it comes to numbers, at least when it's about galleries, is you need to be careful about how how sure you can be about these numbers.
I did an LVMH certification this year through my program at NYU. And one thing that I found very interesting, I wrote an essay about it, never published it.
I want
to. So I was like, this is so boring to 99% of the world, but it was called Fashion Counts Art. Because when you look, at the balance sheet for a company like LVMH, which believe it or not, itself has a balance sheet, they count art. They count fine art. They count that industry and how it relates to them. And in their most recent report, which is public information, I think it was like they said that the art industry and collectibles, so like not just fine art, art and collectibles was only 56 million. Whereas the entire luxury market, including yachts, including private jets, including handbags and couture clothing and everything, is somewhere around 352 million. So the number is like not that big. I had always imagined the art market was bigger, but I'm sure they have some McKinsey-ass people figuring out these numbers, and they estimated it was somewhere around 56 billion.
I mean, look at 2017. There were two reports for the first time, because TIFAF used to be the publisher of this report. Then Claire McAndrews left to Art Basel, and TIFAF continued doing their own report with another researcher from Maastricht University. So same year, same data, same, you know, I would say both authors of these studies were academics at kind of the same level. One came up with 60 billion, Claire McAndrews, and her colleague publishing the TIFAF report came up with 40 billion. So where are we, right? Are we at 40? Are we at 60? I believe if all the galleries would publish their data and make them transparent, we would be at a very different number than the 60 billion. Now, why are we referring to this? Because Claire employs the same methodology year after year, so it can give you a good idea of tendencies and where the market is heading. But is it 60? Mm-hmm. Is it 40? Is it maybe 80? That I'm zero sure about. What I'm sure about is the revenue numbers of the galleries that I mentioned before, because they've been verified.
Okay. So, as someone who looks at art to buy because I love it and because I want to be inspired and I find it a creative outlet, but I also look at it from an investment standpoint, what's some advice that you would give to someone coming in to buy a piece that they're looking for a significant return on?
Buy at the very top end of the market. Mm-hmm. We did a study where we looked at 500,000 artists, mm-hmm. in order to find out what makes an artist financially successful. Mm-hmm. It took us 6 years. I did it together with Laszlo Barabasi, who is probably the number one data scientist in the world.
Yeah.
And we wanted to find out what drives the price. Why do some artworks sell for millions of dollars and other artworks that look almost identical, and maybe were even earlier than the other artwork, sell for nothing? What do you think? What's the result of that study? What drives the price of an artist?
The artists themselves, the community behind the artist.
No. The brands of the galleries that they show with.
What's the answer?
That's exactly what it is. The network that the artist is in. We were able to show that 99% of institutions, galleries and museums, have no impact on the success of an artist. But there are a few galleries who actually do. And as an artist, if you'd like to be financially successful, you need to be part of this tight network, mm-hmm. of a few galleries and a few museums that are super closely connected. And that drives the price. Now, when you ask me, okay, what should I invest in? Most likely, you should get artists from this network.
From those four.
Alpha and beta.
So buy high and sell higher.
Yeah, exactly. So people always ask me, oh, Magnus, I saw this artist for $10,000. Do you think it's a good investment? Mm-hmm. My answer is, without even looking at it, it's probably not a good investment, a financial investment, because those galleries, the alpha galleries and their superstar artists that are part of this central network, their price points for unique works usually start higher, more in the 100,000 or six-figure range.
Okay. And in the book, you make note that an artist essentially has 5 to 10 shows or by the age of 35 to like make it. Can you define what making it means? Is it financial success? Is it getting picked up by a beta or by an alpha gallery?
Yeah, so that 5 to 10 exhibitions refers to the study that we did where we looked at the success factors of artists, and we were able to show that if an artist makes it into the central network, mm-hmm. those relevant galleries, within the first 5 to 10 exhibitions, most likely she will stay there.
Okay.
If you make it early in your career, you stay there. If you don't make it in there early on in your career, most likely you will not end up there. Of course, there are stories of artists that started mm-hmm. low in less relevant, less powerful galleries, and at the end of their career saw this immediate rise. We talk about them, the rag to riches story, but these stories do exist, but they are really the outliers. What we were able to see is that there is a very strong tendencies of artists who join those top galleries, and I'm not only talking about the top four, but the extended list, early on, they will most likely remain relevant.
And you talk about the Holy Land being New York.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Holy Land will ever move out east with like a rise of the Asia markets?
So when we looked at those top players in the art world, the top institution, turns out that 9 out of the 10 most relevant institutions for the success of an artist are in New York. Mm-hmm. Number 10 is in Chicago, Art Institute of Chicago. So it's clearly US-based and it's clearly New York. Mm-hmm. Now, when you ask me, will this change? That's the first question that my students have to answer. The first paper is actually exactly about that question. Do you think the center of the art world will change and go somewhere else? Because we've seen it moving around, mm-hmm. right? It has been in Venice, it was in Brugge, mm-hmm. then Antwerp, mm-hmm. Paris, London. Florence mm-hmm. much earlier. So it always has changed. Right now it's in New York. I don't believe it will be there forever. Probably in our lifetime, we will see a new center of the art world. But you two are much younger than I am. So I don't know if I will see it, but you certainly will.
Are we going to have to move?
I hope not. The art world comes to Connecticut.
It might be Connecticut. You know, I get the craziest answers on that. Obviously, cities, my students write about mostly the cities that they're from. Mm-hmm. So you have whatever, Mexico City, mm-hmm. you have LA, Chicago, and then a lot of cities in Asia, Hong Kong, and so on. Nowadays, in the past 2-3 years, people said the metaverse is going to be the new center of the art world. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I really don't know.
Can you talk about your take on like the blockchain and Bitcoin?
Yeah, of course.
I like that we're covering a lot of ground here, right? We're jumping from investment to the metaverse, now NFTs. Well, I wrote a book about NFTs, so I'm a big fan. Not the actual art pieces. Okay. I think those are collectibles. I'm a big fan of really two things. One, that finally digital artists got some spotlight. So they were neglected forever, right? Digital art never really played a major role. When you look at New York, for years, Bitform Galleries was the only gallery that focused exclusively on digital art. Mm-hmm. That shows you how little it really played, little relevance it had on the market. That changed. Suddenly, a lot of digital artists who were forgotten had some attention and could actually cash in on that, which is great, and I love that. Obviously, most of it is gone. I hope their money is not gone, but mm-hmm. the hype around it is gone. But, and that's the second thing that I like about it, is the technology is fantastic. It would change the art market fundamentally. Mm-hmm. Because what blockchain does, and NFTs, people always think NFTs is digital art. No, yeah. Digital art is digital art. Mm-hmm. It's just another medium. But the NFTs is the technology that powers digital art when it's traded on the blockchain. Mm-hmm. So think about that. I believe in the future that every painting will be registered on the blockchain. Mm-hmm. The moment it leaves the studio, the artist will register it on the blockchain. It has so many advantages. Mm-hmm. So provenance will be traceable. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, the artist gets immediate royalties whenever the work is purchased. The owner doesn't need a piece of paper anymore as a certificate of authenticity, but the owner has the NFT. So whenever he wants to sell it, mm-hmm. he just has to show the NFT. It's much easier. It reduces friction in the transaction. It reduces transaction cost mm-hmm. fees. It makes the job of Sotheby's Christie's so much easier. Mm-hmm. And it gives artists more money.
And it helps prevent forgeries.
Exactly. Yeah. And it allows artists to know where their works are. So I'm a big fan of this. Now, this is not going to happen immediately. Yeah. I think it will first be employed to watches and other industries because the art market is always so late in using and applying new technologies. So, but I think it will happen.
How many years, roughly, do you think until we can apply that?
I just hope that the Louis Vuitton group will eventually introduce it to their luxury items. Mm-hmm. When you buy a handbag or a watch, that rather than getting, you know, when you buy a Rolex, you get this green card. Mm-hmm. I hope in the future it will be a digital version of it, an NFT. I don't think we will call it NFT because the name is just so ugly now and people think it's this trading thing. But essentially it's a digital certificate of authenticity that is stored on the blockchain. So whenever I want to sell my Rolex, I can just show that I'm the holder of the NFT. It's the original NFT because I can trace it back. And I can see all the transactions that happen on it. And once this is employed there, I think the art world will join because they have an interest in that. Mm-hmm. Artists have an interest in that. If Jeff Koons says, I only authenticate the works that are traded using my NFTs, which I will issue now, then every artist will follow. But it needs this top-down approach. Fairchain is mm-hmm. doing a great work. Nana Deccan with his company.
Are they doing a great work? Okay, wait, I want to stop you about that.
And Winston van Aert. So there are a couple of companies.
I think people have made attempts. As somebody who has put things...
You've been very quiet, by the way.
Because I wanted Annie to, Annie's the collector here in this scenario. But she is. But, okay, first of all, I've put things on blockchain, with Fairchain. I think Fairchain is a joke of a company. It's like a ghost ship out in the ocean. Like, zero idea how they're going to do anything. And I did it in goodwill, in good faith, as a good actor to, be a good collector. But I have, spoken at length off the record with a vast array of art collectors who have adamantly said, there is no way in hell that anybody's ever going to do this because there is no inherent value to art. Mm-hmm. The value of art comes from the people that are buying it, who then in turn sort of artificially invent and inflate prices and name a price, like a gallery, they get to name an inflated price. We know this is true. And then the people that buy it, they get to inflate it. And then based on supply and demand, if that's a hot artist and that's in demand, they get to invent and inflate a price again and again and again. There's absolutely no incentive for collectors to become more transparent about what their transactions are. Because the minute that people start to see what a lie and fabrication it is that any of this has this alleged value that we are ascribing to it, the market will collapse.
I disagree on two parts. First, I think everyone who enters the art world with a tech mindset and tries to bring tech to the art world, I support them. They, at some point, I get so many emails by entrepreneurs who say, hey, I like to make the art market more open. I like to democratize it and so on. So I support all of them. And Fairchain, I really like that the idea is, I think the idea is good. They didn't raise much money. It takes so much time to convince people. Mm-hmm. I think the founding team, they're very driven and behind the idea. So obviously...
What do you mean? That team has completely fallen apart.
Yeah, but
I'm going to challenge you on this.
But
with
it's
Fairchain,
very normal.
The founder left. The other girl that runs it, no offense to her. I see her wasted at art parties. I don't see her like advocating for artists and like running a proper company that anybody who's supposed to be like, you know, entrusting a certain amount of like financial validity to. Like, I'm sorry, I don't want to see you blackout wasted at a party running around with your entourage and going on your website and your Instagram that hasn't been updated. This is a fake company.
No, it's
this
not
is a fake.
Fa-
yes,
no,
it is. It is a fake. Go on their website. Their website is down half of the time.
I was in similar positions. Sometimes, you know, you raise money and then you're running out of money because your dreams and aspirations are
their
higher than
the money. Their CEO was ousted. Because
you know,
literally
those things happen in every co-founder.
Their CEO was ousted because a bunch of people from within said this company is bullshit.
You know, sometimes I've been in similar positions that that people, you know, I was running out of money and then I probably went also to parties and, you know, but you can also call it, hey, it's cool that they are actually at parties to network with artists because this whole industry is about networking. But let's not talk about a particular company in general.
Well, no,
I support
just, like,
everyone
get,
who's doing something in the art
world. I would love to hear a good use case for the art, for NFTs, for the blockchain art world.
No, but you mentioned
doesn't
something
exist.
Else.
Doesn't
now,
exist.
I give you one. You talked about inflated prices and collectors. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think existing collectors, yes, they might be against that idea of transparency, some of them. Mm-hmm. But in fact, when we talk about the existing players in the art world, we leave out the biggest potential that is there. And those are the people who are not buying yet. Mm-hmm. We need to convert those. The art market can triple in size.
Why do you think it's so? I used to work at Gagosian in San Francisco. I know the tech.
Well, that's what the name is for.
I know the tech scene very, very well, just like I know the art world very, very well. Why do you think it is so hard to convince somebody who works in tech to buy contemporary art? Because I know exactly why. It's
the lack of transparency.
No.
Why is it then?
Because they think that what they're doing is changing the world. They think that their contributions to humanity are the enlightened moves in reality. They look at all of this visual contemporary art and they're like, those are kids playing with paint. I'm out here like writing code that's changing the fabric of reality. I am the god in this world. I am the artist of this
universe.
Well,
they still buy luxury products. They still buy cars,
but you can't,
watches,
the fundamental houses. Argument for like what art is, what contemporary art is, does not work. Have you ever listened to Elon Musk talk about contemporary art?
Yeah, he thinks it's a joke.
He thinks it's a joke. Yeah. Exactly. That's how most people in the tech world view contemporary art. Yeah,
I've worked in tech for so long, and so many of these people, they're not buying for one simple reason. Mm-hmm. They don't find answers to three questions.
Well,
and those are three.
They don't,
so what should I buy? I'm overwhelmed. Listen to this. So they want to find answers to three questions. Mm-hmm. First, what should I buy? I'm overwhelmed. If you go to an art fair, we all know the experience, right? I mean, it's just too much. Secondly, how much is it? It's so hard to just find out the price. Is it $1 million or is it $10,000? I don't know, because they all look the same, right?
Asymmetric information.
And the third question is it a good investment? Now, in my book, I explain to them, it's not a good investment, so don't bother about the third question. Mm-hmm. And for the first two questions, what should I buy and how much is it? I'm running you through the process, mm-hmm. so it's less embarrassing. And I believe that's the reason why so few people think about Art Basel. 80,000 mm-hmm. people go to Art Basel, Miami Beach every year. What do you think? How many are buying?
2,000.
5 to 10 at Art Basel in Miami. 5 to 10,000.
Okay.
So go ahead. I think three of them are
it's 1,000. So we need to convert the 79,000 that are out there, and we need to give them answers to these questions. I believe transparency mm-hmm. will open up the art market.
So trust me, I've like had this argument in defense of art hundreds of times. With so many different people. I also had to, my job was to sell art in that environment. And I can assure you that their idea of a trophy is not the old world, you know, idea of a painting as a status symbol. For them, it's this ultra optimized lifestyle and this ultra optimized home that if the more you look at like these really expensive new homes that are being built, everything is like hidden within a secret wall and it's all tech based. There's no art. They don't care about art. They wear, you know, the hoodie and the jeans. Like, sure, is there nuance that like, oh, look, he's wearing On Running and he's wearing Adidas. Sure. But like, they do not have the same value system that I think is an old world thing that the art world has. Like, the art world is a very conservative, traditional, patriarchal place in the world. And I think a lot of people who view themselves as future-facing, and we'll just pretend that Elon Musk is our number one subject, they look at it, they think it's a joke. They think it's a joke, and they're like, I'm not spending that much money on that thing. So there has to be a market correction, because we should be able to capture those people. There should be a level of transparency, 100%.
And NFT, blockchain,
I completely agree with you.
And a lot of other technologies.
But like, we need but these things because the art world needs to be tiered and versioned. And the tiering and the versioning on the lower ends. So like, you know this because you teach at a business school, right?
Yeah.
Game theory. Right. What is it like, the hangman's game or the dead man's game, where it's like everybody is waiting for someone to move because everyone's afraid, like, if I'm the first one to move, does that mean I'm the first one to die? Like, there's this weird strategy where people think that if they're the first ones to really be transparent, whether it be the emerging market, whether it be people within the mid-tier. I knew somebody, Esther Kim Verrett, who runs various small fires in LA. Mm-hmm. She was, I don't know what she's doing now, but she was really on this tip for a long time. Let's put everything on ArtNet. Mm-hmm. Let's make ArtNet just completely transparent about all sales. Let's do that. But guess what? Nobody wanted to get on board because everyone's like, well, if I give my data, mm-hmm. if I show mine, what if somebody's like, you know what? I don't want to show mine, but thanks for your data.
Yeah.
And then people won't do it. So there's this like, everyone's got their gun drawn and everyone's like, who's going to do it? And somebody has to just be the one that's like, it's okay. And honestly, I think at the lower end of the market, we have less to lose. There's way less to lose. Like, you walk in, I know Birkin bags or Hermes or whatever, that can also not be super transparent. Mm-hmm. But like, you can go into a Louis Vuitton or a Prada, let's say, which is still luxury. And you know what the prices are. You just know.
And you can walk out with one.
And you can walk out with one. I have this like very strong feeling that one for one, for every house that has a Louis Vuitton, there should be a fucking canvas on the wall. Like, at least, bare minimum. I mean, if you're, I mean, in my dream world, if you shop at IKEA, you have a piece of art on your wall.
Yeah, best-selling artwork in the world.
It should be like that. And it shouldn't be looked down on as bad.
Okay, but we agree on everything that you just said, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. I was just
curious.
Or I don't know. Do you agree? I'm the one talking.
No, that's exactly what I said.
Yeah. So this is great. I think it's the lower market that maybe would be the best suited one to just say, you know what, guys, like, fuck it. It doesn't, because these emerging markets, I don't know what you call them, Sigma, or I don't know. I'm sorry, I'm bad at the Greek alphabet. That, like, are, you know, these lower tiered galleries, down market galleries that are selling work, they're losing out anyway, because if they do produce a great product, i.e. a highly sellable artist, they'll get picked up by another bigger gallery, then they'll get picked up, and eventually, hopefully for the artist, they go mega. And then guess what? All those little baby emerging galleries, let's hope they bought a piece or two along the way, because they just lost out on years and years of investing in an artist. So actually, I think it's going to have to be the mid-tier, unless we have like Louis Vuitton or LVMH come in and buy a Gagosian, mm-hmm. for example. I mean, they're a publicly traded company. They're going to have to put those assets in a book somewhere, and it's going to have to be on at 10K. We're going to have to be able to read that.
Yeah, and I agree with you there again, because I believe that the change that we both want to happen is most likely not coming from within the art world, mm-hmm. because those people at the top have an interest in keeping it the way that it is, mm-hmm. because they built up this reputation and knowledge for so long. Why should they change it? I believe it needs a bottom-up movement, and that only works if more people enter the art market. So if there are more people interested in entering the art market, which is happening right now, then eventually some galleries will say, all right, what do they need? They need full price transparency, and then we need to cut all the bullshit talk and make it actually less exclusive, less VIP, but open it up.
More people entering the art market, meaning buyers, gallerists, artists, buyers.
So yeah,
we have too many artists and mm-hmm. too many galleries yeah. for what it is right now, because we have a huge oversupply of art.
Artists and art, yeah.
And meeting little demand. Mm-hmm. I mean, with Larry's List, which I co-own, we did a study where we counted the number of collectors who are spending more than $100,000 per year mm-hmm. over the course of 5 years on art. Mm-hmm. I mean, we came up with 3,000 that we found, you know, and it took us several months to do it. And we believe there's another 3,000 of people who are just not publicly talking about their art and what they're collecting and so on. Make it 6,000, 7,000, but it's less than 10,000 people mm-hmm. who are really fueling that market. And we're only talking about those people, always. We're only talking about the mega gallery, the big art fairs, and the big artists and the few collectors. Now, I believe the conversation needs to change entirely, and we need to talk about those people who are left outside of the art market but have the potential to buy. And for those, we need transparency. And for those, I've written that book. Mm-hmm. I'm really driven by that idea to bring in more people into the art world, because if there are more people in the art world, mm-hmm. things will change.
We agree with you on that. But let me ask you a question, because we talk about this constantly. We talked about this one episode ago. How do we do, this is the hardest question. Yeah. How do we do exactly what you're talking about, but make it cool?
Yeah, I build an app.
because I feel like the minute you say the word transparency, people are like, nope, I don't want to do that. It's not cool.
So I'm working on this from every angle, because the outcome of this is that more people can actually live from what they love doing. Artists can live from it, galleries can live from it, who are all putting their heart out for what they're working on right now, but they don't get the response, they don't make the money that they deserve. I mean, I'm thinking about all these people who work in galleries, they're working so hard, and all these artists, they're working so hard, but they don't get the financial return which they should earn. Mm-hmm. If they would have put in so much hours and work in a different industry, real estate, finance, and so on, they would all be millionaires,
yeah. mm-hmm.
right? But in the art world, it's just not like that. It's much tougher. Now, one way to do it is, you know, that's why I wrote this book. I believe if more people enter the art world because they understand how it works, then a lot of people will benefit from it. Another thing that I'm doing or why I'm doing, I'm teaching at Yale, the MBA students, because I believe out of these MBA students, some of them will convert into art buyers.
For sure.
I take them to art fairs, the first time ever that they visit an art fair, and I teach them, one of their goals is when we visit the art fair that they come back with 10 artworks and the prices. So they have to go through this embarrassing process of asking for a price and, you know, talking to gallerists. That limits or reduces their fears. So next time when they go to an art fair, they feel more comfortable and eventually they buy something. And the third thing that I did is several years ago, I don't know if you remember, but I had an app that worked like Shazam for art. So you take a photo of an art piece and then it would tell you the name of the artist, the price and comparable prices. So that was a cool app. We had almost 1 million downloads in the shortest period of time with no advertisement. Mm-hmm. And it worked very well. Unfortunately, it was taken out of the App Store because galleries complained that we displayed their prices and comparable prices. And then Apple kicked it out. But that was
another
way. That's crazy. Could you like reverse sue them for like antitrust bullshit?
Well, they had a point, right? We had over 10 million images of artworks, which all represent copyright complaints. So.
Okay. So, I just took a microeconomics class.
Yeah.
Which I loved. It totally changed my perspective on the art market, the art world, as a, you know, little baby MBA student. And the funniest example that my professor, Joseph Foudy, used over and over again was the wedding industry. Mm. Do you know anything about the wedding industry?
No, I've never been married.
You do. I do. So the wedding industry is a lot like the art market. The wedding industry has a lot of issues with asymmetric information and price discrimination based on, like, they will size you up. They will figure out quickly kind of what you're worth, what the event is for. The minute you say something is for a wedding, price is 10x. It's for a wedding. Because they know, like, this is going to be the greatest day of your life. It's such a status symbol to have an incredible wedding. They know that like every little add-on here and there, and the next thing you know, this thing you went in for a simple thing, I want flowers on the table or I want flowers for the cake. Next thing you know, you're sold like this crazy package that would be way less if it was just like my husband's 32nd birthday because they know it's your wedding. And so they totally target these women mainly and like, rip people's bank accounts apart for this. And I was like, wow, that's very interesting. That's a lot like the art market where, I mean, obviously there's cursory Googling. I know galleries that use way more, you know, software that's way more than a Google to look at people's net worth, what they've done, who they are, asking them what's already in their collection to get like, you know, alleged very specific data, forcing them to suffer through gallery dinners, forcing them to buy artworks they don't really want just to eventually get to the artworks that are the status symbol artworks that someday maybe can turn a profit. I mean, it's really crazy how they get collectors on the hook and long term where like you can't I remember working at a gallery once and these Japanese people walked into a gallery. And they wanted to buy something that was on the wall. And it was very clearly a rich man, his wife, their art advisor, and then maybe like some colleague or an assistant. So it was four. Mm-hmm. They walk in and they wanted to buy something. Immediately it was like, oh, well, we need to go get the senior director. Mm-hmm. You know.
That's what I call the beauty contest.
God forbid. Mm-hmm. You know, the senior director is interrupted from booking their flights to St. Bart's next or whatever the hell they're doing, coming out. What's in your collection? Who did you buy it from? Like, just, you know, analyzing, like, the wife had a crocodile skin, Himalayan Birkin bag, that meant something. Like, sizing this one. And these Japanese people, sweating. They were sweating, like going through the list. And in the end, the art director was like, give me your contact. I'll call you. And like walked out. But what I watched was like this amazing psychological game that they just, the senior director actually played and won on them, where they were so desperate to get that thing. And they were, in fact, more desperate after that abuse. And I don't think that, like, the rest of the world who may be busy raising children, have a sick parent at home, paying a mortgage, trying to, you know, deal with little Barbara's soccer games or whatever the fuck, have the time to, like, be abused and, like, go through this rigmarole to just, like, get access to something that some people view as fundamental.
Yeah, agree. I think what you experienced there are brilliant marketing techniques, right? So so many people who work in this industry, those directors at galleries, they're doing a fantastic job in playing one marketing strategy. And I applaud them for that because they're actually working extremely hard. And they did a great job in creating this allure that exists around art, especially at the top end. And funnily enough, you also have it at the lower end where we all know that they're just desperate to sell, but they're still playing this exclusivity card. I think in most cases at the top end, this might be the right marketing technique, right? How you sell a Rolls Royce is also different how you sell a Toyota. And they just define that that's their marketing strategy, their sales pitch, fine, good for them. I think at the lower end, I'm always surprised that galleries who open up, they still follow the old Castelli model, the Leo Castelli. We don't display prices. Mm-hmm. We want to have a conversation. We don't sell works. Mm-hmm. We place them.
Yeah.
And
so gauche.
That logic just doesn't work for every gallery. And I would say for most of the galleries, it doesn't work anymore. We live in a different time. Mm-hmm. We are used to have all the information available immediately for free. Now, when I have to go through this beauty contest, and that's what's happening along the price range, it just is annoying. And that's keeping people away, and that really has to change. But on the other hand, I must say at the top end, that might be a technique that is working. And these people, I've met so many people who work in galleries, I have so much admiration for them, because what people like Larry Gagosian, David Zwirner did is they're true entrepreneurs. They build up a fantastic company that is highly profitable, and it worked for them. But their model doesn't work for everyone else. Mm-hmm. But they're all trying to imitate them. And that's what I don't get. Where is the, from young gallery founders, where is their drive to innovation? Where's their drive for change? Why do they all follow those rules, those unwritten rules that the others, much larger galleries, are employing?
Mm-hmm.
What works for them definitely doesn't work for them.
It's a little bit like being in a cult. Mm-hmm. I would say it's like being in a cult as somebody who's, you know, literally did grow up in a cult for a period of my life and then joined the art world. Go figure. It's like Stockholm syndrome that I ended up in the art world. And I think about how the cult around Larry Gagosian, the cult around David Zwirner, the cult around any of these galleries, Hauser and Wirth, my God, and the silence and the fact that people treat it like it's talking about the mafia, if you even sort of start to do what you do in your book, which is just kind of cursory, give people like a little bit of a roadmap about how to navigate this, you'd think that you were like marching them into public with their pants down.
Yeah.
You call it a cult, which has such a negative connotation to it. I would just say those top galleries have done a great job in branding themselves and making sure that their brand stands for something, because the truth is also the moment any artist enters those top brands, their prices go up. So that's how powerful these brands are. Why do younger galleries that are starting out fresh, who are not playing in that league, why do they copy that approach? That's because art fairs, in order to get into art fairs, galleries, other galleries decide over galleries. I mean, when you think of it, clearly you have to play along the lines, right? If I want to get into Art Basel, if other galleries decide over my application, then clearly I'm not going to be the game changer that annoys everyone else. And the other thing is, even those smaller galleries are going after the same collectors. So obviously they subscribe to the same language and the same techniques and so on.
But that's where it feels like a cult. Mm-hmm. Because if it was pure, clean and simple free market capitalism where people had to compete on quality and price like they do in almost any other industry, the art world would be a very different place. And you'd be able to find things truly at, like, maybe there would be a price correction.
Yeah.
And there would be people enabled and empowered to enter the market at whichever level they felt comfortable.
And talking about this, $500, mm-hmm. right? I'm always surprised when you look at price points of galleries. Average price point in gallery, median price point in galleries is $7,000. Mm-hmm. So, but as it turns out, people are willing to spend less than $5,000 on art. So clearly there's a mismatch. You have the demand side mm-hmm. that says, hey, we want to spend less than $5,000. I actually like to buy something for less than $1,000. That's mm-hmm. where you have the largest amount of demand. But then the offer is so much more expensive. So that's where the conversion gap is. People are offering something that just the buyers are not willing to spend. So when we talk about price correction, we need to focus at the lower end. And when you look at auction results, most art that they are selling, over 80% sells for less than $10,000. So you really have the demand at the lower end of the market. And you just posted something which I found really interesting, where you said, hey, send me your art for less than $500. Right. If I go out to my friends and say, hey, you can buy art for $500, they say, really? Mm-hmm. Art is so expensive, because it always has this exclusive allure around it. But tell us about your experience, the $500 experience.
Okay, well, it feels like it's been this winding journey. So I got the inspiration from reading your book this week, because I think quite early on in the book, you say, set a budget for yourself mm-hmm. when you're beginning. And you said, start it at 1,000, right? I was like, 1,000. I, you know, looked at my bank account. And I was like, I don't really want to spend $1,000 right now.
But you're rich now, right? Aren't you represented by UTA?
I live comfortably, okay. but not because of UTA, okay. let me assure you.
Right. Her own hard work.
Anyway, I have financial responsibilities. I have a budget to adhere to. So, you know, I looked at my budget. I was like, okay. This got paid this month. This got paid this month. I'm saving for this. I've got, Lord knows, I've got to go to Switzerland in June. And the oxygen is 500 francs a minute there. So, you know, I've got to hold some dollar bills. So I was like, I'm not even going to do the $1,000 that Magnus recommended. I'm going to do 500 because that's what I feel like I can afford today. So I put a post online saying, hey, I've got $500. I won't go above it. I won't go below it. What have you got for me? And within a few hours, Annie, I was like live texting to Annie because I'm like, oh my God, either I struck gold or this was a mistake, because 2 hours in, I had over 1,000. And by the next day, I had 2,000. And we've lost count now. My poor Pia, who is going through every yep. single submission to make me this PDF. It's crazy. It's crazy how many works were submitted to me. Now, one could argue, oh, you know, they're not, those works really aren't that price, but they're doing that. They're selling it to you at that price because you have a big platform. But to that, I would argue, sure. But who made up that price? Mm-hmm. Is the artist saying that that's the price, or is the market dictating? Because no big market players have DM'd me and said, hey, Hildy, let me sell you something for $500. I would say with complete 100% assurity, it has been people who live in relative obscurity who applied to this. So no one famous, no one known, no one zeitgeisty and cool. These are just people that follow my Instagram account. So because I have this argument with people where people are like, some people said, oh, you just created an act of mass humiliation for all of these artists who would have to lower themselves to sell something for $500. And to that, you know, my argument back is and was, yeah, but who set that price? Mm-hmm. Because I can tell you right now, like, I think that whatever X thing I do is worth this much. But unless there's somebody willing to pay me that, then there's no market for that. That's just my opinion. That's my personal feeling. And there's a lot of people, and I feel bad for people. I'm one of them who, you know, spent $150,000 on an art degree And guess what? I came out of art school with a lot of desperation, thinking I needed to make artwork that I potentially would sell expensive enough to like pay back those debts and live in the most expensive cities in the world. But guess what? Newsflash, and I know it sucks, and I hate saying this because I'm an artist. I identify with the artist struggle. I get it. But unless you have not one, not two, we'll say 10 to 15 people consistently willing to pay you a certain price, then you don't have a market.
Which applies to most artists. Mm-hmm. That's why the number one degree that leads into unemployment is?
Fine art degree.
MFA.
Yeah.
And I'm always shocked. That's why in my classes at Yale, I invite Yale School of Art students to sit in it with MBA students.
And that's cool.
Yeah, that's nice.
And bringing them together, I always tell MBA students, this is your moment to buy art at an affordable price. And the MFA students, I tell, hey, your clients are right there. Yeah. Don't talk about collectors. They're sitting right next to you. So that always happens. And that's beautiful to see. But I'm always surprised how many artists are contacting me later after they left art school and have no idea how to price their works. Mm-hmm. And then I always ask them, so how much do you think you should price them at? And they always say the same thing. They say, my friends are pricing them at $6,000.
Yeah.
And then I tell them, well, that's not how you should look at prices. You should look at the demand side.
Yeah.
Because that's where the market is. If you want to sell your works, don't think of prices as signaling power to show relevance to your art. Because that's what they do, right? They like to price it over $10,000 because then it's more relevant than if they price it at $1,000. But that's just wrong because you cannot live from reputation, fictional reputation amongst your peers. You need to pay your bills. So you need to see where the demand is. Mm-hmm. And as it stands right now, there is little demand to no demand for most art that is out there. That's why so many of them end up in unemployment and actually need to leave their careers and do something else. Mm-hmm. I really want to change that. How to Become a Successful Artist, the other book I wrote in that series with Fiden, tackles exactly that question. And what I'm proposing there is, hey, artists, first of all, I don't know, nobody told you at MFA programs, but there is a market and you need to sell your art. So you cannot just sit in your studio and create something. And then when it comes to pricing, think of the demand side. And thirdly, don't rely on galleries because most galleries are not going to get you the demand that you want. So your number one goal shouldn't be to find a gallery representation, which it is. By the way, they still think that gallery representation changes everything. But as we found out, 99% of all galleries don't have an impact on your career. Mm-hmm. So you have to do it on your own. As an artist, you are an entrepreneur. Yeah.
Okay. So when I got out of art school and I realized my degree was fucking worthless, I could have gotten the same degree by going to the library and just going to openings and getting to know people and maybe doing an internship. Mm-hmm. That's
because
why I'm
the network is more important than the actual.
And that's why I'm actually a huge proponent for people that listen to podcasts. I say drop out of school right now. Unless you were born exceptionally rich and you will never, ever, ever have to deal with
that I will lose my job, right?
Art school.
Stay in school, kids.
No, drop out of art school. But when I realized how like backwards and pathetic my college degree was, and this is why I'm in business school now at 38 years old, I'm like, I should have like in the first half of the degree shouldn't be a studio class, shouldn't be an art history class, shouldn't be anything, should be business school. Mm-hmm. You should have to go to business school for 2 years. Mm-hmm. To understand, like, and people get mad at me and think I'm being annoying when I explain.
I always say the same thing.
When I explain, like, markets.
Yeah. Don't do that.
No. Like, if I tell people what a market is, what supply and demand is, what a contract is, why you need to have it, how you need to figure out what your costs are, coming up with a business plan, like, all these things, like, first of all, the old artist side of me is like, oh my God, Hilda, you suck. You are so profoundly uncool for telling people they need to like adhere to rules and understand the economy and the way things work. But then I'm like, no, it is so reckless. It is so naive. It like to think that you could just go get this degree and that like baby artist will get taken care of by a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
No, there is no guarantee for that. Mm-hmm. You actually have to know how to be a really good business person. And once you get to that level, if you want to stay at that level and keep making money and have a great career and become canonized, guess what? All those people are good business people.
Yeah.
They are all good business people.
Yeah.
So like there's really no, in contemporary art, you have to. Unless, again, you're just independently wealthy, mm-hmm. then fuck off and do anything you want and invite me to your party. But like, I'm talking about idiots like me mm-hmm. that went to art school and actually thought I would, I didn't know how to make a CV when I came out. Like, I didn't know how to do anything. Just,
you know, when you look at my YouTube, the most viewed video is how to write an artist statement.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, I was surprised, right? The lack of marketing skills mm-hmm. that art students learn and are willing to be talked about at art schools is always shocking to me. The UK has done very severe steps into that direction. They just limit the amounts of spots for MFA students
yeah.
because they realize, hey, this leads into unemployment. We have to reduce the number of people yeah. we let into unemployment. This all, if we summarize this, really, this all is about the problem of the existing art world mm-hmm. to talk about money, about market mm-hmm. aspects. It's a dirty word still in the art world, even though it is a market and people need to pay their rents. I'm trying to change that. You're trying to change that. Yeah. We're all trying to change that. And it needs, and there are a lot of people out there who are doing things in that direction. And I'm supportive of all of them. The art world has so much potential to grow, and that needs to be exploited. Mm-hmm. The book is really one step in that direction to explain people the necessary steps that they need to do in order to feel comfortable in this art world. And the reception that I received so far is pretty good because it really demystifies all this art world mm-hmm. slang and those mysteries around it.
Maybe you need to pivot from teaching at business schools to MFA programs.
Well, I'm doing this with my one book, How to Become a Successful mm-hmm. Artist, is really that. And then I offer one-on-one coaching okay. through my online class, magnusclass.com, mm-hmm. where I help artists mm-hmm. in one-on-one coaching and also online courses, mm-hmm. how to write an artist statement, how to create their Instagram and what to put on it, how to price their works, mm-hmm. how to network, how to identify galleries that fit to them, how to approach galleries mm-hmm. That fit to them, and also to make the decision if they really need a gallery. I've been coaching artists who are now working completely without galleries because they've made the decision and said, look, 99% of all galleries don't really have an impact on my price points. Yeah. Maybe I have to do it on my own. The first chapter in my online class is change your mindset, become more entrepreneurial.
Yes.
So as an artist, you really need that. And you are a great example of that. And there are a few others. I mean, I'm coaching this one artist. He started 3 years ago. He's now making $350,000 revenue per year, mm-hmm. solo, no gallery, just by himself. So he's actually keeping that. And that's beautiful to yeah. see. And there's so many artists out there who just need that push in order to become more entrepreneurial and be brave enough to do it on their own against the resistance of the traditional
art. So yeah. when I was saying earlier about the cult mindset, I hope that's an apt example, but I just want to say, like, the traditional art world with galleries, there are so many artists who think, unless I have a show at a gallery that eventually leads to placement in an institution and in a museum, unless I have a trajectory that looks something like that, I'm not valid as an artist. Really, if you dig deep with artists and talk to them about what matters, I was even shocked when Beeple, mm-hmm. who like killed it at Christie's, made a hot 66 mil, he could have bounced or he could have stayed in the online universe that he'd created for himself. But for some reason, it remained important for him to have an exhibition at an art gallery, and he was courting Pace.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very deeply ingrained in so many artists and so many people that, like, unless I have this level of validation, I'm not an artist. I'm not real. And I, like, am constantly trying to beg people because I was forced to be an entrepreneur. I have a degree in conceptual art. Let me tell you how worthless that is. Mm-hmm. I was like, what in the fuck am I going to do? So I had to start working. And I did a million different jobs. I did like every kind of job, worked in galleries in all different levels. And what I learned from that situation was No one was coming to save me. I had to save myself. It was my responsibility to save myself. And in doing that, I made myself relevant. I made myself available and more interesting to a broader public. And now people do pay me a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But like, had I been sitting around waiting for like some curator, like fucking kill me. I would be in the streets right now. I don't know where I would be if I had just sat and waited for the, do you know the art world still cannot admit that I'm an artist? Like, I constantly have people that are like, well, you're not an artist. I'm like, what do you think all of this is? Of course I'm an artist. They can't see it. And I'm like, thank God I don't need them to tell me I'm an artist, because I would be in big trouble if I was sitting around waiting for a gallery to validate everything I do and then figure out amongst their roster of however many people on their little batting team when it would be my turn to maybe make some money. Like, it, no, I'm sorry. Life is too short and the world is too expensive. We have to be entrepreneurs. I'm sorry.
What I find so interesting is the art world and business entrepreneurs have one thing in common. They're all in. I mean, I'm always admire these gallerists who are starting galleries and everyone who works in galleries. They work really hard. It might look from the outside that they're chilling and,
you know, partying
and so on, but they're really working hard. They're extremely well educated. They spent years at college and doing all the readings and so on. They're networking, they're being out. Art, being in the art world is a full-time job. And it just makes me sad that often artists just don't know why they don't sell. Mm-hmm. And often galleries don't know why they have to close down. And then relating it to themselves. As an artist, I don't sell. Maybe I'm worthless. Maybe my art is worthless. And that's painful. No, you're not selling because nobody knows about your work. Yeah. It's not your work. Mm-hmm. It's about the marketing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is the difficulty that mm-hmm. you're having. So start marketing your art better and then you will find success. Same with galleries. It's not about you. You as a person are not bad. The art that you have mm-hmm. selected is not bad.
And I think
but it's about your marketing that is bad.
Wait, and that I has to change. Like three pieces of advice you'd give an artist then. Like, what do you give them in your masterclass?
I tell them, so ask yourself if you really need a gallery. Mm-hmm. I tell them, be more entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. In any case, even if you're with a gallery or if you do it on your own. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is have a very clear branding, meaning when you look at artists' Instagrams, when you look at their websites, when you look at artist statements, they're so confusing, mm-hmm. right? You need to have an identity as an artist that I, just by looking at it for 10 seconds, can grasp and then can tell a friend. I mean, artist statements are wild. They're all the same. The language, I mean,
they're
English
so
is my third language. I need a dictionary to read them. And then I think, but tell me something about who you are as a person. Yeah. So be more authentic and don't try to impress someone from your community, but try to write and address your art to a much larger audience. And it works. Mm-hmm. I mean, the online class and the book, the feedback I receive, it's mm-hmm. very rewarding mm-hmm. to get this feedback where artists say, hey, it really had an impact on my career. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm selling more works because I actually followed some of the advisors. I give you another example. Artsy did a very interesting study where they were able to show that when a price is posted on their website, this work is four times more likely to sell. Four times more likely. Every e-commerce marketing person would die for a four times conversion increase mm-hmm. just by one simple change, mm-hmm. posting your price. So I always tell artists, when you post your works on Instagram, first of all, don't do only a solo shot of the work. Put it into a collector's home. There are apps where you can do this for mm-hmm. little money. So make it look like it's actually hanging, so I have an idea of the size. Mm-hmm. Secondly, in the description, put the name, the size in centimeters and inches, mm-hmm. and the price. And you will see that it actually helps you to sell. And then artists, no, we don't want to post the price. The art world doesn't like that. My galleries or future galleries might not like that I post my price. Maybe the prices are too low and so on. And I tell them, well, the future galleries don't care about them. Yeah. Don't care about your colleagues because they're not selling either. Mm-hmm. Care about yourself and care about potential buyers. And they want to see the price. And then after pushing them, eventually they do it and they sell. And then they write me and say, oh, yeah, thank you. Now I'm going to do it forever. So artists, if you're listening to this and seeing this right now, post your price whenever you post a work. It has a dramatic change, scientifically proven.
It's so funny. 2 weeks ago, now I'm starting to sound like I'm more of an art collector than I am. I was on Artsy. And I was like, I love this one painter, Patricia Treve. Do you know her?
No.
She's so great. Do you know
her? No, I don't.
She's wonderful. And I was like,
represented by?
I have no idea. I don't. She teaches at Columbia. That's all I know. But I was like, I want to buy a Patricia Treve painting. And so I go on Artsy because it was the old, because I'm sorry, like anything else, same with buying a fucking Rolex, right? You're like, okay, you don't have to give me the exact dollar and cents, but I want it. I thought with ChatGPT, I would find something. Like, generally, what are the prices for a Patricia Treve painting right now? And of course, it was like, based on the thumbnail, we cannot find
based
the data.
Based on the survey, like, 2021.
Yeah. I was like, God damn it. So then I go and I find some works for sale on Patricia Treve on Artsy.
Contact Gallery.
Yeah. Guess what? They respond to me 4 days later with a price. Yeah. And they say, and let us know if you'd like to see more works. And we'll, in any other e-commerce buying situation, you instantly see the price. Mm-hmm. And not only that, like, you can add on all the shit you didn't know you wanted while you're checking out and be done with it. I mean, in full transparency, I bought a fucking watch this week that was not a small purchase.
Yeah.
And
what did you get?
I got a nice watch.
Okay.
Small watch.
I got a Rolex Yachtmaster. And
there you go. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Why didn't you buy art, Jerry?
I am buying art for $500.
Oh, you read my book. The book is a love story.
This is
to
an
the
investment. That has good resale
this
value.
It does have resale value.
You're investing in yourself.
No, more
important.
So anyway, but I bought this watch. It was amazing. Because I could buy it really fast and get everything certified mail, blah, 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 all my authentication. The prices were very transparent online. It wasn't a small purchase. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt completely safe making it. And it arrived perfectly intact, just as I needed it, et cetera. The end. That's a big purchase, you know, like a lot of money. Meanwhile, I have this fake conversation happening in Artsy land where the person clearly doesn't take the time to Google who I am and the fact that I'm inquiring on a piece. I think clearly, like, if you Google image me, you can tell I have an art collection.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or you know that I'm an artist, very active in the art. Like just the amount of inadequate laziness and...
Yeah, you call it laziness. I just met so many people who are so hardworking in these galleries. I just think they are overwhelmed with all these other tasks. This task should never require somebody to respond. It should just post the price. Mm-hmm. There should be a checkout button, just like Artsy does, buy now, and that's it.
It should be that way,
but
there's all these systems in between, and I do think it falls into the cracks of laziness because people look down on people that buy art on Artsy. Mm-hmm. Galleries too.
I think they're Artsy, like, is a great website with a great team.
Yeah, because you're progressive and you like tech. The rest of the art world, the rest of the art world doesn't. They look down on it. They judge it. They're like, oh, that's trash. If it's available on Artsy, then nobody wants it, which isn't true. I'm not saying that's true. But so there's no impetus. So then when I'm reaching out on Artsy and I'm very earnestly like, I would like to buy a Patricia Treve.
Yeah. How much is it?
I have to look in my email, but it was a tiny work on paper. I gasped at the price because I was like, I'm not paying that much. Mm. Maybe if it was a canvas, but it was like a tiny work on paper for $11,000. Yeah. And I was like, no, I'm not doing that.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Especially because I'm not doing it for investment purposes. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it for love purposes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't abuse me like that. But I would love to know if Patricia Treve, in a very earnest, honest moment, could tell me, like, when's the last time you had a check for your paintings? Because I would venture to say that if these prices came down and if making the purchase was just easier, yeah, just like I went and bought a Rolex this week, because clearly I'm a consumer who's willing to spend, click a button, next day mail, boom, 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 goodbye. I don't want to think about this. Instead, I get an email 4 days later when I'm like driving and like looking down and I'm like, oh, I've got to deal with this later. Yeah. Got to log back into Artsy and like have some weird stilted conversation through an app. It's bad. It's terrible. So it's like it should just be easier. And then people talk shit about things like, you know, David Shrigley, mm-hmm, who's like got the Shrig Shop, mm-hmm, which I love. I have a print from the Shrig Shop, or people that do edition works online, and they look down on that kind of collecting. But again, I can assure you, that was three clicks. No, that was click on the one I like, mm-hmm, add to cart. It auto filled in my address, PayPal.
Yeah.
Forgot about it. It arrived a week later. Thank you very much. It was $500, and it was $500.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Yeah. So the younger galleries, and I'm always waiting for this movement to start, that younger galleries actually challenging the status quo. Mm-hmm. And so far, I haven't seen many doing that. They're still following the traditional model, which, as we said before, doesn't work for everyone. I think that the biggest change will really happen if more people enter the art world and constantly ask these questions. And that's why I wrote the book, How to Collect Art, because I want to convert people from art lovers into art buyers. And from all the 20 years of experiences in the art world, some parts interrupted by starting a tech business completely outside of the art world, really led me to this. In my classrooms, I think I can argue that I've been asked a lot of questions about the art world, and I try to find the answers to them and present them in this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, then our audience should read the book. And you know what I want to say, and this is a promo free from Magnus, from me about Magnus to you, dear listener at home. This is a good book for artists to read too. Like, I think that maybe on the outside, you're like, oh, this is not a book for me. I'm an artist. I don't need to read how to collect art. But actually, this book is incredibly insightful because I had a fabulous NYU professor, love her, Anat Lechner. She got up in front of the class right now and she goes, hey, guys, quick question. How many of you think that you're a good person and you're doing well at your job? Everyone's like, you know, raising their hand. And she's like, when's the last time you asked your clients? And everyone's like, oh. And mm-hmm, she's like, exactly. She's like, if you don't know what your clients, mm-hmm, think about you and how they're, mm-hmm, thinking and how they're perceiving you, you're not doing a good enough job,
yeah,
instantly right there. So I think for an artist too, this is a very valuable, insightful guide because you need to understand who your clients are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great book all the way around.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And for those people who are watching and listening, I can really encourage you to buy more art. The art world really needs that. Artists require buyers. They're all most of them are struggling. So if you see something, approach them on Instagram, write them a DM, ask the gallerist, and buy art. Art is very affordable. For less than $1,000, you can start. And if it's the beginning of your journey and you are hesitant and you're not sure what to buy, you can always reach out to me. I actually reply to every email that I get. It's magnus@magnusresch.com. You find my email also in the book, or you can reach out to me on Instagram and I will tell you my view on it. But I can tell you one thing, and that I'm very convinced about after having spoken to the biggest collectors in the world. The first piece that you buy, you will never forget, and you will also never regret it,
yeah,
because there's a story around, mm-hmm, it. So when you see something that you like, just go out and buy it.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for being on ArtsMag.
Thank you, Magnus.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
ArtsMag is produced, edited, and mixed by Joe Tisdall. Thank you, Joe. We love you.